Okay, thank you, David. No, I'm going to talk about plenty of experimental results. Can we get rid of this thing? Well, I guess you just pull it. Yeah. Well, good morning, everybody, or afternoon. Naturally, it's a great pleasure to be here at my own workshop. I'm going to try to uphold the traditions of the seminar by having a slideless seminar, and if I'm really an artist, I'll make it a chalkless one too, but we'll see. I intend to kind of have a dialogue, so so I encourage questions from the audience, especially from students, if there are any. The reason is because the issues raised by the cuprates are actually deeply philosophical, and they have to do with what physicists perceive their science to be, and more generally, what we're all trying to do instead of get rich on Wall Street. So I'm going to talk today about the broader view of the cuprates, and in particular, what it has to say about other branches of physics. Now, I don't believe in Trojan horses, so background. I want to do this for the express purpose of undoing everything Patrick Lee said last week. Because Patrick views the problem as a technologist, and I don't. I am constantly reminded of a famous quote of my father-in-law, who's a dyed-in-the-wool Yankee, grew up in Maine. He said, you know, economics used to be really good until they made it a science. Technology. In the physics of the vacuum, perhaps it's not so clear whether principles of emergence are at work or not. I happen to think they are, but the truth of the matter is you can't tell. But certainly in the solid state they are. And this is something that I think people who haven't been had their trial by fire in the subject don't appreciate, and so I'm going to try to give you an appreciation of that. Solid state physics, on the one hand, is trivial because we know the equations of motion. We know the underlying equations of quantum mechanics. There are some tiny corrections due to relativity, some even tinier corrections due to nuclear physics, even tinier corrections due to modifications to the standard model. But by and large, we know, we understand the underlying equations. And everything that has been done measured on small molecules and small physical systems tells you this. Now, the question comes, what about big ones? And probably many of you remember when and if you took your first solid-state physics course, you got reminded of how metals act like electrons in boxes, and insulators act like electrons in boxes that wiggle, and they diffract, and that's pretty much it. This turns out to be false, and the phenomenon of high temperature superconductivity is just the latest of a whole string of weird phenomena that are not calculable from first principles. They go under the moniker of correlated electron physics. Now, I want to play a little experiment, do a little experiment now. I'm going to ask my solid state colleagues what a correlated electron material is. I hear chuckles, that's good. Any takers?
No, that's depressing.
Just say like Congress is a correlated electron matter. I think Matthew's answer is not so dumb, actually.
It's a well-understood, highly correlated.
So Steve says something like the quantum Hall effect. Any other takers?
Something in which single particle theory doesn't give you a reasonable way of thinking about the problem.
Good. All right. Any other takers?
I second that.
Rocco seconds that. Let's see. At this point, I am going to use the chalk. Let's write down the equations, just so we know what we're talking about here. Let's leave light out of it. Okay, so we got some electrons, we got some ions. Let's have them interact. Let's have the electrons repel. And let's have the ions repel. Okay, good. Now, those are the equations. Now, Steve says, first of all, Matthew says it's something we don't understand. Just look at that. Everything in there you understand. But of course, everybody knows in quantum mechanics, the number of dimensions kills you. And so very often the matter organizes itself in ways that are surprising. And lots of times they do this in ways that you don't understand. So the problem of finding understanding is not finding the ultimate equations, because we know those. It's finding how they move, how they work, to give simple behavior that you can describe with simple equations. Now, Steve says something like the quantum Hall effect, where one electron theory doesn't work. Well, why is there any reason to believe that one electron theory would work here? Now, let me tell you what one electron theory is, because those of you who don't work in solid state physics would never guess it in 1,000,000,000 eternities. Well, I'll tell you. First of all, we make the ion masses infinite, and we freeze them, so they're classical, okay? Then, we make a hypothesis for the electron part of the wave function, which is a single slider determinant. And then we minimize it. And then we hope that the orbitals out of which this single slider determinant are made describe particle-like and hole-like excitations of the electron gas. Now, it turns out that this series of wild, uncontrolled approximations for miraculous reasons works. Works for some things, but it turns out it fails when it fails. Naturally, if you try to do that agenda in liquid helium-4 or nuclear matter or something analogous to nuclear matter, you would find it wouldn't work. And so you'd have to invent more sophisticated techniques, technologies. But you see, even that is no good, because the natural energy scale of those tree-level equations is it's a Rydberg. It's 10 electron volts. The phenomena that we're looking at in solid-state physics are down in handfuls of degrees Kelvin, which is 5 orders of magnitude less. And so if you wanted to sort of deduce these behaviors, you would need computations that are accurate to a part 10 to the fifth. Therefore, it's nothing short of a miracle that a bunch of electrons obeying that equation in potassium metal do indeed act as though they didn't interact. Now, Steve says, well, a highly correlated material is one for which they don't do that. In other words, this miracle doesn't occur. Now, even though the quantum Hall effect is naturally my favorite subject, let us ask, are there any other examples where it doesn't work? Any other examples?
I'd actually like to add one more definition.
Yeah.
Which is, these systems are ones that theorists don't predict prior to experiment.
He says, theorists don't predict prior to experiment. Well, that is true, okay? And lest you folks smirk too much, there's a reason for it. And the reason for this unpredictability is the very thing I want to talk about today, which is the last little footnote on my title, which is the dark side of emergence. Now, let's see, you had a
Something else
that doesn't categorize into
high temperature superconductors.
Ah, the high TCs. Now, what an interesting statement. Well, it's interesting because you'll find that not everybody agrees. When the high TCs were first discovered, of course, we were shocked because all of our approximation techniques said that it would be impossible. Okay? The fundamental limit based on these predictive methods that had so far worked very well was about 30 degrees Kelvin. Now we're up to 160 and climbing, and that's just way outside the error bar. Now, presumably this had happened before. This had happened before, it just wasn't far enough outside the error bar that you could make a good argument. But this is so far out of the error bar that there's just no doubt, and all the first principles modeler threw up their hands in despair because it just didn't fit. Now, the real question that one should have asked, probably, when this happened, is why should it have fit in the first place? There's one definition of highly correlated that didn't come out of the audience, but often does, and it's darn it, because I like to nail the people. It's usually an unwitting graduate student who has been to one too many seminars and picked up on the jargon, and the poor student says, oh, I know. It's a material for which the Coulomb interactions are large. Coulomb interactions are large. And you see, this is the thought process we go through, because you see, if we've gotten rid of the ion motion, which is a no-no, actually, really, but if we've gotten rid of the ion motion, then the only thing left that we can't handle technically is the Coulomb interactions. You see, if you turn off the Coulomb interactions, then the problem decouples into a problem of one electron moving in a periodic potential, and any fool can solve that problem. But when the Coulomb interactions are there, then it's multi-configurational problem, and nobody knows how to do it from first principles. So you say all the Coulomb interactions are responsible. Then I pounce on the poor graduate student, and I say, no, read your chemistry books. The virial theorem always guarantees in ordinary matter this energy and this energy are the same size. It's not true that solid-state physics is perturbative in the Coulomb interaction. Coulomb interactions are one. They're always one. They're one for everything. They're one in the human body. The reason is if they're not one, the matter won't balance. That's how it determines what density to be. So rather than being in a weak coupling limit or a strong coupling limit, you're always in the worst imaginable limit, namely the coupling constant of one. So you might ask, well, how in God's name can we do perturbation theory in that thing if it's one? Right. Well, of course, the answer is formally there's no justification whatsoever for it. Instead, it's phenomenology. I like to recount an interesting thing that happened. When I first went to work at Livermore, my boss was an astro guy. And he sort of understood solid-state physics as a slave discipline that you will calculate equations of state with and stuff. So one day he came into my office and saw me calculating and said, oh, you're a phenomenologist. And I didn't understand at the time that this is the worst imaginable insult he could have given me. So I said, I thought, you know, I'll deal with phenomena. Yeah, I'm a phenomenologist. Well, of course, one always is when one has to confront experiments that are complicated. And indeed, in the case of metals, the existence of the metallic state or the existence of the insulating state, in fact, they don't exist because the human mind said they should exist at all. They're actually miracles of nature. They're miracles. Perhaps the insulating state is not so much a miracle, because it could arguably be adiabatically deformed into something that doesn't have any Coulomb interactions. But metals, on the other hand, are really a stupendous miracle of nature. And they are example of what I like to call self-organization of quantum matter. Now, please forgive me, those of you who've been in physics a long time know that this is BS, that in fact, we would talk about a fixed point of the renormalization group, but it turns out that your average junior chamber of commerce doesn't understand what that is. So I invented a new name for it, which just says the same thing, namely that it is a fact that matter organizes itself in such a way that as you go to lower and lower energy scales, universal behavior emerges of its own accord. And when I say universal, I mean that all model dependence vanishes away and you get behavior that you can count on as being true. And the lower you go in energy, the more true it gets. So, because I have observed the metallic state in nature and I've observed it, I know that this miracle really happens. And this astonishingly infrared sick quantum system managed to sustain itself all the way down to tiny fractions of a degree Kelvin. And certainly, the metallic state as we know it phenomenologically spans 5 decades in energy scale in some cases. So you see, when we talk about a technological approach to physics, we are, at least in my discipline, we're always cheaters. We're always making use of the fact that states of matter exist. They're highly protected, they're highly universal, and this comes about not because we can calculate it, but because it is so. The matter organizes itself so as to make this universality emerge. Now, there's a field theory for a metallic state. In fact, there's a field theory for lots of things in solid-state physics. And even though it's completely obvious, I'd like to make the point that it is because of these phenomena, these natural occurrences in nature, that the field theories are valid. In other words, metallic state doesn't exist because we have a field theory of it. We have a field theory of it because it exists. Because the low energy degrees of freedom decouple at low energy scales and they become independent free particles and they become more and more exactly free particles as you go down an energy scale. And then we can make a field theory for them. And the universality, yes?
You invited us to be.
I did.
So there is something that does exist that, I mean, in a sense, the technology exists for, which is the proof of the stability of that fixed point or of that field theory.
Yes. Yes. Go ahead. That's true. This is true, and this is a wonderful bit of self-congratulatory doublethink, I believe. No, excuse me. I meant as an indictment of myself rather than Steve. Steve is, of course, right. You can assume certain properties and then assume and then discover that they are consistent. That is to say, all perturbations to them are irrelevant. This you can certainly do. Now, this is not the same thing as proving that the metallic state exists. This is saying we assume that it exists and then we show it's stable to perturbations, small perturbations. Now, whether nature decides it's going to have such a state or not is entirely up to it or her, as the case may be. But we know that it happens a lot. And so Steve is absolutely right. The metallic state is studied a lot. We know that it's reasonably stable. Or do we? Any of y'all remember the RVB? Phil Anderson's resonating valence bond. A great many of us have written papers with RVB in the title. I still do it occasionally, although I won't tell you what the sign is. And Phil's idea was, based on the phenomenology of the cuprates, that maybe the metallic state didn't exist. Maybe the metallic state was fundamentally unstable to something else. Maybe the phenomenology of the metallic state was fooling us, and the perturbation theory that showed that the metallic state was stable was wrong. Now, shocking as it may seem, after all this time, this particular argument is still not resolved. So we've resolved it the way we commonly do in solid-state physics. We've resolved it by experiment. So whether I personally think we could make an argument on the board that with realistic Hamiltonians, the metallic state is always unstable, and Cohn-Lottinger allegedly did this, in fact. But in light of the facts, experimental facts, it's silly. You can take copper down to millikelvins, and it's still a nice metal. No sign of superconductivity, no sign of antiferromagnetism, no sign of instability at all. So as a practical, empirical fact, the metallic state is quite stable.
You're saying you could prove that copper is unstable?
Nope. Steve, I'm taking issue with. Steve says you can show the metallic state is stable. Steve is right. You can show the metallic state is stable with some optimistic assumptions. You can make another argument with less rosy assumptions that proves that it's always unstable. Now, what the scoop is in nature, we don't know, except empirically. I think that's fair, isn't it? Okay. Yeah, we don't know except empirically because, of course, all the graphs you have to sum are of order one. Okay, so you don't have any predictive power. The predictive power that we have in the theory of metals comes out of the metallic state itself. It doesn't come from our technology. In fact, our technology is piggybacked onto the fact that the metallic state exists. Now, it turns out we snooker young graduate students into the field by telling them this small fib that we are technologists and we can calculate stuff starting with these known equations. Only later, after it's too late, do we explain to them, well, that wasn't really true, that in fact, part of our discipline is the most abominable thing imaginable, chemistry. But it's true, actually. A lot of what we know about the world is based on empiricism, just like chemistry is. And so this is both the strength and the weakness. If I have a physical principle at work, I know I can trust it. At the same time, I usually can't prove that principle. Now, the metallic state's probably the most sexy of them all, but of course everybody knows the story of superconductivity and broken symmetry, spontaneous broken symmetry. Superconductivity, let's see. I was a graduate student when these names got invented, okay? And so it took me a long time to disentangle them. Now I tell my students spontaneous broken symmetry is Latin for crystallization. Crystallization is the simplest example of it. There are lots and lots of other examples of continuous symmetry breaking. Superconductivity is the superconducting state is the more interesting one. Of course, you know the story of BCS, how BCS made finally the theory of superconductivity, and Feynman was very embarrassed and horrified and put the paper in his drawer and didn't read it for 2 years because he wished he'd thought of it. Now, this is, I don't believe this story is apocryphal, I believe it's true, but poor Feynman shouldn't have been so upset, because the truth is that the broken symmetry is a principle. BC and S invented a mathematical description of it that works in some cases, namely the simplest metals, but it needn't work always. It's technology, and the technology can easily fail even though the principle underneath the superconductivity, namely the degenerate ground state, can still happen. It's taken, I think, about 13 years in my own discipline for this dichotomy to be straightened out in people's minds. In the beginning, many of us were worried that the superconducting state in the cuprates was fundamentally different from the superconducting state in lead. And the reason was, when we used BCS technology to compute certain properties, it didn't work. Then the experiments came in. The it was found there was Jellison tunneling from conventional superconductors to ITC ones. Well, that proves that the broken symmetry in the two cases is the same. And then there was the low energy heat capacity, the low energy penetration depth, which, as the samples got cleaner and cleaner, got more and more simple, began to look more and more like liquid helium-3. So as the experiments came in, the low energy properties of the cuprate superconductors became known, and every single domino fell. Every single hypothesis we made of a fundamental new state failed. Now, that's not to say that we have any first principles description of the high energy behavior, but the protected behavior, the universal behavior, the behavior that all superconductors of its type must have, this textbook, the Meissner effect. All these amazing things superconductors do. So we are faced historically with a breakdown of the paradigm of physics as a modeling technology enterprise.
I don't understand it. It seems to me this is a great triumph of effective field theory. It's sort of obvious if you've given. I mean, what else could have happened? I mean, the fact that
I deny having put David people, in the audience as a straight man.
Other people might have expected something else. They had
all right.
Scenarios that it was only effective was so hard.
Okay. Thank you for asking this question.
In hindsight, one should have had the courage of one's beliefs.
Well, this is a beautiful example of the confrontation that I'm talking about. The answer, the response that you just gave was, well, there is a technology. It's effective field theory, and it worked. And I guess I'm challenging...
Great predictive power.
And I guess I'm challenging that view.
But
I'm challenging that view.
This is superconductivity. I mean, the only effective field theory we know has a Van de Ginsburg. Predict.
David. You've hit the nail on the head. Okay, it's the very thing that I want to get on the table today and discuss. Right? You say it worked because the technology worked. I say the technology worked because it became superconducting. In other words, the field theory is merely a codification of all the universal properties of superconductors at low energy scales. And therefore, when you're in the superconducting state, it will work because of universality. In other words, it didn't become have all these properties because the field theory said it should, I claim. Instead, the field theory worked because it has all these properties. In other words, go deductively from this to high temperature superconductor is something we cannot do. Now, we thought we could do it with lead, but it got a little harder with the A15s, the Chevrel compounds. Nobody even bothered to try it with the ternary borides, which are astonishing materials that have antiferromagnetism in them also, something they should not have had. But always in those cases, the superconducting transition temperature was low enough that you could wave your hands and say, well, this is details. Like they said on Wall Street when the tech stocks went south last spring, shift happens. in the case of the cuprates, the error bars are so large that you just can't make that argument. Now, anyway, to get back to your remark, this is exactly the issue on the table when I said, where does field theory come from? Field theory, does it emerge, or is it technology? Are the superconducting properties what they are because the field theory is valid, or is the field theory valid as a corollary of the self-organization of the matter that occurs when superconductivity happens? Now, obviously, I'm sort of proselytizing this afternoon for the latter view, namely that field theory, low energy effective descriptions of things are natural phenomena and they aren't technology at all. Now, you have a question? Yeah. Sorry?
It's more of an objection than a question.
Okay, object away.
You make it sound as though effective field theory actually predicts nothing in the sense that it's just an encapsulation of all the experimentally observed phenomena that occur in superconductors. And but clearly one does gain things from effective field theory in the sense that you need only a certain number of assumptions about your effective field theory, and you can predict hopefully more things from that field theory. Mm-hmm. So
Okay, good.
When you talk about starting from there and deducing, making direct predictions or microscopic, I mean, there's an intermediate level of starting from there and getting someplace. Namely, the arguments that lead to effective field theory, locality, decoupling of different scales, can be argued to follow from there. There is a line of arguments. It might not satisfy some rigorous person, but a lot of the assumptions that come into effective field theory are consistent and can be argued from that microscopic starting point.
All right, now, guys, I'm on your side. Believe it or not, I love low-energy effective field theories. In fact, in this business, high TC is such a harsh mistress. It's the only thing I love. The rest of it, the rest of these facts, as Mark Twain once said, you kind of wish they would all go get drowned together. Now, so I'm not dumping on effective field theory. I'm instead asking a question, and it's a good one. What is it? I'm asking, what is effective field theory? Now, you're absolutely correct. If you know an effective field theory, sometimes you can calculate things with it. Let me give you a nice homegrown example. The BCS theory of superconductors is built on the effective field theory of metals, which we call Landau-Fermi liquid theory. And it works. It's quite quantitative. And so what we do is we use the low energy degrees of freedom of one state of matter that are protected and universal as the building blocks for describing another one. And the history of physics is rich with examples of such things, and it's a perfectly good way to proceed, provided that it works. In the cuprates, we have all collectively been trying to do this very thing for 13 years, and we have failed. And while you can debate this endlessly, there are obviously two reasons why. One is that we're all morons, or the other is there's a reason. There's a reason why you can't. And that this reason, as you quite correctly point out, impugns the idea of effective field theories as always working for all things. All right? So this is the very issue that I want raised this afternoon, and it's the very issue that's implicit in the high TC problem and why it is important. Why it is important for all of field, all of physics. Namely, it is directly relevant, an experimental test of the idea, what is field theory? Now, I'm going to take the liberty of writing down a picture, which is you all have to understand that I came to understand the renormalization group rather late in my career, but it doesn't matter. As a result of having done that, I'm a little more bold at writing pictures. This picture is stolen from fractional quantum Hall literature, but it needn't have been. It's basically the same for all continuous second order phase transitions, continuous phase transitions. So what I'm showing you here are two measured properties of some matter. And so we get some matter, it's a point on this diagram, and then we're going to make the matter of the sample bigger and bigger and bigger. And what we find is that these measurements change as the sample is made bigger and bigger and bigger. So as the sample gets larger and larger and larger, there's a tendency of it to flow in one direction only.
Are these coupling constants in effective field theory, or are they physical observables?
They're physical observables.
No, I beg to differ.
Come on, Matthew. This is pedagogical.
No, but they're physical observables. They're different scale sizes.
They're physical observables in different scale sizes. So if we talk specifically about the quantum Hall problem, then these are measured conductances. Measured conductances is a function of sample size. Now, you could plot more precisely and pedantically. You can have coupling constants. You can make the flow with infrared cutoff. You can make the flow with ultraviolet cutoff. It turns out they're all equivalent ways of saying exactly the same thing. Now, these attractive fixed points are one of the two known kinds of universality that we know. They mean no matter how the starting variables are adjusted, when you examine the thing at the lowest energy scales, it flows to one of these two places and acquires universal properties.
I have a naive question about this diagram. When you change the actual size of the piece of material, you get different conductances.
A great question. It's true. No, I'm sorry. I mean, the question you're asking is not dumb at all. It's absolutely true. These experiments have been done, and it's absolutely true. The renormalization really does work with sample size, and it really changes as the sample size gets bigger.
It varies
from system to system. Where you see that flow diagram mostly is in quantum Hall literature, and there. This is a different subject from what I want to talk about, because that's a dirt phenomenon. And there, what you're seeing is the phenomenon of localization turning on. Localization doesn't exist for things that are very small. It only exists for things that are large. It's a thermodynamic concept. And so as the sample size gets bigger, localization sets in, and you get one of the two phases. When the sample is small, it hasn't localized yet, and you can't tell which phase you've got. Now, this diagram that I've put up is actually a paradigm for any second order phase transition. And the point I want to make is that the stable fixed points that you see in formalism correspond to something physical. They correspond to a state of matter that heals its wounds. If you perturb it ever so slightly, the properties will change, but then if you renormalize down, look at the behavior on lower and lower energy scales, the perturbation that you applied vanishes away, and up comes the universal behavior. It is impervious to damage, in other words, as long as the amount of damage is small. You might even argue that this is why anything is measurable and exact in quantum physics at all, when you have a large number of degrees of freedom. So the quantum of Hall conductance and the quantum Hall effect, or the quantum of magnetic flux and the Meissner effect, all of these things are absolutely stable quantities that you measure in physics, and all of them require the thermodynamic limit to be true. They aren't true when the sample size is small. Now, whether there could be other examples of such, as I call it, protection in nature, is anybody's guess. But this is one of the two kinds that we know. The other kind that we know is the universality of the phase transition, separating them. And for the phase transition to be second order. Second order phase transitions in quantum mechanics are rare in solid state physics unless they are dirt mediated. So we know a lot less about them empirically. But as with the stable ones, there are irrelevant directions, perturbations that you can make which disappear, are healed as the energy scale gets lower. But there are also relevant directions, things that get worse as the sample size grow. And these are the variables relevant to phase transition. Now, you all know this, all right? Everything that's on the board here, you know. I'm just reminding you of it to make a point, which is that the existence of these fixed points are really physical phenomena. They're not mathematical artifacts. They exist in nature. And that, if you could tune the underlying equations just so, then you would be able to measure all the properties of this point at zero temperature, just as you can at finite temperature, for statistical mechanical ones. And of course, the, that, that thing is a little picture of the universality of metal, or the universality of a superconductor, or the universality of the crystalline state, stable to perturbations. Now, this is, each of us thinks about the mathematics of renormalization his own way. I've now explained to you my way, but it's a free country. Think about any way you like. But what I hope you will do is reflect a little bit after the lecture today about this question that I've raised. I mean, whether you think the fixed point phenomenon that we talk about mathematically is a natural phenomenon that emerges, or is a mathematical construct. If you discover such a thing in nature, is there any likelihood at all that your mathematics could be wrong? I personally think that it isn't so, that the fixed point phenomena that we have observed in nature are basically phenomenology. And that means that we could be easily fooled in nature, if it were so, by finding universalities that we didn't know were there. Now,
has there been any case of the universality that was predicted by a theory and was then discovered in nature?
Matthew, you want to handle that? I'd say no. He says, was there any universality not discovered empirically first? Just predicted by
predicted theoretically.
What example would you give?
I mean, the best, classical critical phenomena,
right.
There are lots of examples. There are examples where experimentalists found non-universal critical exponents and the theorists told them to go back.
Wait. Now, you're going way ahead of me. Okay, I think what Steve is telling you is true, but also revisionist. What I remember is the story is that critical opalescence was discovered by the experimentalists long before we had a theory of it.
That's true.
Okay.
All
right, now if we're asking about phases, stable fixed points, I think it's fair to say there are a couple of examples. The famous one is Landau never believed that stable antiferromagnets existed, and he wrote papers saying so, and it was only after they were discovered by neutron diffraction that he gave in. So this is a stable antiferromagnetic phase. I guess you might say the antiferromagnetic, actually maybe that's a counterexample. The antiferromagnetic phase was anti-predicted by Landau. Do you have an example?
How about the Luttinger liquid, stable fixed
point? Oh, great example. Luttinger liquid is something that's on everybody's plate nowadays because, like many 1+1 dimensional problems, it's solvable exactly. And I think it's fair to say that in the quantum Hall edge states, it was discovered, thanks to Matthew and others, that there is indeed a special kind of soft universality associated with the quantum Hall state at the edge that we hadn't figured out in the beginning of the subject. In fact, it's even arguably more important than what happens in the bulk.
It's a little hard to say when a phase is discovered, because
Look, it's 1 o'clock.
Right.
How much can I run over?
Keep
going. Tell people, okay. Just don't throw tomatoes. Yeah. As a man who was up to his eyeballs in strong interactions as a young man, I think I know.
And part of it is the chiral symmetry phase transition.
It's still open, right?
No.
Okay.
But recognizing that as a distinct phase is a collaborative effort.
Okay. I'm going to agree with you. And actually, this is very relevant to the discussion we're having here. Namely, you look at the examples of universal behavior, self-organization in matter. I told you the metallic state's basically discovered, superconductivity is discovered, antiferromagnetism is discovered, crystallinity is discovered. Crystallinity, by the way, is not always true. If the nuclei are too light, it becomes a liquid. Superfluidity in liquids is also a kind of universality, superfluid state. So you may go down a long list of the amazing macroscopic self-organizations that are known in nature, and essentially every single one of them was was discovered serendipitously.
Because of flux lattice, that's probably predicted more so.
That's a good answer. That's a good counterexample. Arbor-Kosoff did in fact predict the flux lattice before it was seen. That's true. Oh boy! Now, Costello-Stallus. Costello-Stallus is a very special phase transition. And let me ask you a question: is the hexatic phase established to be true experimentally? Good. Okay, that proves it. No. The point is that it's very hard. It's very hard to tell if you the Costello-Stallus phase transition is. Very famous phase transition in that the lower dimensionality makes it solvable. It has an exact solution. But the history of the phases being separated by the Costello-Stallus transition is very confused. So that's a good discussion. There are a handful of phase transition kind of universalities that we know about. Most of them are either high finite temperature thermodynamic ones or dirt mediated. And the dirt ones are special, in my view, because the fact that dirt, something that's dirty and random, gives any universality at all, I think is a miracle. As far as I know, the theories of dirt that we have are kind of amazing. Well, they're phenomenological fits to the facts, for the most part. I don't know of any way to prove that a dirty system should exhibit any universality at all. It just appears to do so. Now,
Bob, actually, for dirty systems, one can do a normalization group following distribution functions of local variables, and I think it fits into the same.
It does. It fits into the same in the sense of A, namely, if you know what's happening, then you can do it.
Yeah.
But if you took the same computational machinery and then attempted to predict protein behavior, it would fail. And the reason is because the protein behavior is not protected in the same way that the conductivity is protected in the dirty system. So if you've got something that's going to organize and make life, then the organizing principles don't help you anymore, and the calculation fails. Now, so now I want to get back to David's point, because it's very important. Especially in this time now when we're waiting for the next big accelerators to be built. Shocking as it may seem, I love big accelerators. They've told us a lot. But while you're waiting for them to be built, one is kind of stuck in these long historical periods where there aren't any experimental facts to chew on. And so it's easy to forget that Nature lies to you about how it's organizing itself, because experiments are complicated. Very often they're polluted with sample problems. The guy didn't do it right. People are telling untruths about their high quality samples. I didn't really mean they're not telling untruths. They're telling great big lies about the high quality samples. So now, let's suppose that it just happened that you had in your matter a very powerful repulsive fixed point. And what I mean by powerful is that the exponents of the irrelevant variables that suck you in are very large. So that what you might call the basin of attraction, although it's not attracting, you know, it's repelling.
Basin
of repulsion, thank you, is very large. Well, then you get a sample from your sample grower, which begins life at very low, very high energy scales up there, and then you start measuring it, and you make the sample better and better, and the temperature lower and lower, and you begin to see all this neat universal behavior, this incredible universal behavior, and it could even go over enormous decades of energy. Okay? But then you go to lower energies and suddenly it changes and it becomes something you know. Well, if that were to happen, you would be easily fooled. by not doing an experiment that goes to low enough temperatures or low enough energy scales. You could be fooled into thinking that you've got a new state of matter, but you don't. What you've got is something that's almost as good, namely you have an unstable fixed point with a very large domain of influence, but like the Cheshire Cat, when you go to examine it more carefully to make sure that it really is a phase of matter, what you might find is it would vanish away. It would vanish away and you would fall away at very low energy scales to behavior that you know. Furthermore, it would work in reverse. Remember how renormalization works, going up an energy scale is the same thing as flowing backwards. So once you're in the scaling regime, then if you're deep in it, then going up an energy scale can easily take you backwards to the repulsive fixed point. So you could easily find a situation where you've got universal behavior at intermediate scales, which looks very simple and regular, and yet has nothing whatsoever to do with the organizing principle that eventually emerges and prevails. Now, there are many of us who are beginning to worry that this may be what has happened in the cuprates specifically and the correlated electron materials generally. For some reason we don't understand, there is a quantum phase transition somewhere in the vicinity that's very, very strong. And it dominates the behavior at high energy scales, and it causes universal behavior to emerge that is very simple, goes over many decades, and doesn't tell you anything about the underlying superfluidity. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but what I'd like you to do is kind of in your mind think a little bit about what would happen if this had occurred, if you were in fact near a quantum phase transition that was very, very strong. It has some implications that are very interesting and directly relevant to David's remark about experiments are complicated. For example, suppose you go to very, very low energy scales and you measure. You might, for example, measure some superfluid properties, Meissner effect, and you'd find they were all textbook. But then you might go up to higher energy scales like in optics, and you might look for telltale signatures of BCS superconductors. And what you might find instead, as you go up in the frequency scales, you might find a power law. You might find some really simple universal behavior and be very curious about it. Is this the spectroscopy of the parent state out of which the superconductor grows? What is this? So you see, if you have a very powerful fixed point, it's quite possible for the high energy spectroscopy to be unimportant. That's one lesson. There's another lesson.
It's important for the behavior.
It's important for the phenomenology, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I think the picture I completely agree with, but the conclusion of what's important,
Folks, wonderful. I want a discussion about what's important, right? Physics is quintessentially the science of what's important, okay? Mm-hmm. As opposed to chemistry. I'm probably going to hell for these remarks, by the way. Right? Steve? Well, Clinton got off. It's good enough for the president, it's good enough for me. Anyway, the meaning, when we're talking about, well, Tom, I guess, where's Tom? You're going to talk about quantum critical points 2 days from now, right? So one of the things one's got to do sitting in the audience is ask, so what? Okay, and what I'm trying to do is get some digestive juices going here and so imply that there is a so what, and the so what has to do with epistemology. It has to do with what you mean about experimental science. If you go up in energy scale and you discover universal behavior associated with the phase transition, you will learn nothing about the microscopic mechanism of superconductivity by measuring it. You see, that when you measure universality, that simply means that you've found a universality. And the universality, by its very nature, is blind to microscopics. It's completely model independent. So you see, if in BCS theory, we are accustomed to going to high energy scales and probing the parent metallic state as a test of whether our theory is right. But if one did that same experimental agenda here, one would be testing something completely different. You'd think you were testing models, but in fact what you're doing is confronting a new kind of universality, new kind of universality that is dominant at high energy scales but not at low. Now there's something else. Sorry.
I mean, in a situation like this, wouldn't you have two tasks, the theorist? Mm-hmm. One is to understand those IR fixed points, which is where the superfluidity fluidic length is only a BCS-like, and the other is to understand the propulsive high energy.
Okay. David says, isn't your task to understand them both? Absolutely. But you see, we've got a little problem here. So you're right. You're absolutely right. As a theorist, you want to understand things. And universality is one of the many things you want to discover. Okay? It just turns out that this kind of universality is hard to find. There really, in fact, aren't any examples in solid-state physics at all, except for dirt-mediated ones. And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that's true. And see, this is very odd historically, because the repulsive fixed point is the backbone of the standard model. Right, repulsive fixed point universality is allegedly responsible for a lot of the simplicity we see in the vacuum. So the fact that it's been so hard to see in the solid state is sort of historical oddity. Okay, something that you wouldn't worry about as a theorist, but from the point of view of experimental phenomenology, you could very easily be fooled by one of these things because we've never seen one before. Very easily be fooled. Now, there's another implication, which is the forward direction. It turns out, as a practical experimental matter, repulsive fixed points are brick walls. And I mentioned one of them. Namely, if you're trying to infer the microscopics from what you see. Obviously, in the superconducting state, one wouldn't be able to infer any microscopics because that's universal. So you go up an energy scale looking for symptoms of the microscopics, and what you'd slam into is more universality. And so this is sort of not good for figuring out fixing the underlying equations. Okay? Repulsive fixed points are not good for that, but they're not good for something else too. Suppose you're a reductionist, which all of us are, and you want to take the equations and solve them, get the answer. So what you do is you go to some small sample, make Hartree-Fock or something else that you know will work there, okay, and then start scaling up in size, but of course your calculations have errors. And unlike attractive fixed points, repulsive fixed points don't forgive errors, they amplify them. So you could very easily make a little slip way in the beginning and prove that 2 plus 2 is 5, assuming that you were going to get protected, but in fact you've been sabotaged by this repulsive fixed point. In other words,
why did the real system get sabotaged in the same way?
Very interesting question. One of the most interesting features of these materials is that the experiments don't reproduce. This is the gist of the joke about high quality samples. You see, in the beginning, we were comfortable with blaming chemistry for the samples problem. This was before we had a handful of 5 or 6 ace Japanese materials growers making samples. And then all the doubt vanished away that there's a fundamental problem here. Okay. Now, the joke about high-quality samples is a universal joke. Actually, it's a joke to the theorists. The poor experimentalists have to get up and defend their measurements. The fact that the measurements don't agree with previous measurements on allegedly identical samples is difficult to live with, so one usually hides it and bluffs with a phrase like high-quality samples, the highest quality. So the highest quality samples are the latest ones. And in fact, the truth is they vary all over the place, and it's not their fault, right? Or I think it's not their fault. You see, if you were near an unstable fixed point, then little tiny sample inhomogeneities would be amplified by the quantum mechanics of that fixed point and make the sample look a lot dirtier than it really is. Okay? So your question's a good one, and in fact, I think there's evidence suggesting that that's exactly what has happened in the cuprates, and that's why we don't ever like to talk openly about how irreproducible the results are.
You might still be able to say something about the distribution of possible answers.
Ah. So you might be able to say something about the distribution of answers from microscopics. Indeed, you could, within some error bar. You know, we people who do quantum mechanics for a living don't like to put error bars on our calculations. Why? Because we're always cheating. You see, we're calculating the properties of potassium or something, or the properties of silicon. So I do my calculation for silicon, and it comes out to be a Bandon slater. And all the universal properties of Bandon slaters are right. So I say, ha, the equation, it worked. Now, the band gap is off by a factor of 2. All the effective masses are screwed up. But never mind. You know, the universality we got right. Now, it turns out, however, that there's a handful, a sort of class, of these materials in the world that are not protected in this way, and they've never been calculable. The calculations get even the wrong phase. They get miles off. The energy gap of nickel oxide is 2 electron volts. The calculation that we normally do say it has to be a metal. As a matter of principle, because it has an odd number of electrons in human cell. Spin polarized Hartree-Fock gives an energy gap of 2/10 of a volt or something. So it's off by a factor of 10. Why? No one knows. The cuprates are another example. Every honest calculation ever done on them gives a metal. If you cheat a little bit, you can get them to be an antiferromagnet. No one has ever gotten them to superconduct the way they actually do, with the highest transition temperature known to mankind, without cheating. So it turns out that the cuprates are a beautiful example, but there are many, many more. Once I asked my colleague Ted Jabal, whose case none of you know is one of a really great man of science, if he would tell me all the modern slaters, because this is a buzzword for these materials that act funny. And he chuckled. He just laughed. He said, go read Landolt and Bornstein. So I went to the library and began reading Landolt and Bornstein and writing down examples, and I gave up after 300. There are thousands of these materials that don't reproduce, have strange properties, they tend to be brittle, they tend to be sensitive to imperfections, they tend to break, they tend to be black, and to absorb light very well, for reasons nobody knows. Okay? You just wave your hands and say the chemistry has spoiled the materials, but the truth is we don't know. Now, the issue on the table in cuprate superconductivity and the related matter of correlated electron is there a principle that's causing these problems? Not chemistry at all, but physics. And if so, what is it? And if the answer to this is yes, then there's a corollary, namely, what else might this physics be hiding that you didn't know about? Room temperature superconductors? Why not? If you don't have predictive power when one of these babies is acting, then you don't have any right to say that room temperature superconductivity is impossible. Now, so yes, this is the issue. Now, physicists are it's an inherently reductionist, so we like to think of ourselves as knowing of having the deductive path back to microscopics. These materials are suggesting to us that maybe that can't be so in at least some cases, and furthermore, the road is blocked both ways. You can't infer the microscopics from what you see because it's highly protected, highly universal, even at intermediate scales on the one hand. And second of all, you can't go deductive from the microscopics down to the phases because small errors in the calculation will be amplified instead of healed. So that means that if there is such a thing happening, then it changes the way we relate to experimental science, changes the way we prioritize things. Some, right, not all knowledge is equal. Not all experimental facts tell us get to the bottom of things. Not all kinds of experiments you could imagine doing would reveal the pernicious nature of such a thing or even reveal its presence. Now, I started off my talk today with a sort of rhetorical question. I mean, what is a correlated electron material? And we didn't get too far on that, but I'm not surprised because you never do in a fora like this. It's a very difficult question, and I want to put it to you that maybe the answer is that a correlated electron material is synonymous with a material near a quantum phase transition, continuous quantum phase transition, one or more of them. Namely, that a correlated electron material isn't a class of chemistry compounds. It's not a thing, class of things defined by chemistry, but instead is a class of things defined by physics, intermediate scale organization. And I would also propose that this is a good question, that it's one of the things we ought to be focusing on in our endeavors to straighten this matter out. Namely, are there physical principles of universality that have a dark side that are preventing us from approaching the problem, our problem of organization of matter, the way we're accustomed to doing it? And if so, how do we circumvent it? I, for one, am deeply suspicious that all of these materials as a class have at least one powerful quantum phase transition lurking in them, and that this is what is making them so hard to figure out. And I put it to you that if this turns out to be so, then it has implications. Because if you think about what we're trying to do with the vacuum right now, we're trying to do exactly the same thing. We're trying to infer the microscopics from what we see. We're trying to suppose microscopics and work deductively from them to figure out what the low energy spectroscopy of the universe is. And if there is a very powerful repulsive fixed point up there, then I put it to you that it might be so that the problem of solving the universe might be mirrored by this much more humble problem of trying to figure out organization of electrons, and may be difficult to work through as a matter of principle until machines are built that that are powerful enough to transcend, to escape protection, as we say. Okay, this is a good place to stop. Thanks all for staying and for your questions.
Somehow you painted it as a dark picture, but it seems to me in a Cooke phrase, the worst case scenario than what you're outlining would be that, just a second, that you don't begin in the physical system to get any fixed point whatsoever, just out of no man's land. It's a very non-universal crossover. This is quite optimistic. There's actually one fixed point.
Okay, look, somehow, I've given a talk down here on this matter twice, and somehow in the previous incarnations of this talk, it's interpreted as negative, and I don't want to be negative at all. One of the things that good physics is getting to the bottom of things, no matter what that is. So if it turns out that the cube break problem is not a modeling problem, then we need to find this out right away and not waste time trying to prove to the 2 plus 2 is 5. I don't think that it's at all negative when you've gotten to the bottom of things. This is what science is all about, and it's the triumph of the human mind over nature. Now, also, it opens up avenues. You see, if we're constrained by a strategy for confronting experiment that was appropriate in the last war, it could be that we will not make progress, because it looks like you have no understanding sometimes. But maybe, as happened with the strong interactions back in the 70s, maybe the definition of progress needs to be changed. Maybe the definition, we need to make dichotomies between what is important and what is unimportant so as to move forward. And actually, I don't think that the analogy is all that unapt. Okay? I think this period in history, worrying about electron self-organization, is a little miniature of the crisis that happened in quantum mechanics when the strong interactions were solved. So I don't think getting over the problem of not computing baryon spectra is negative. Okay, I think that was a wonderful event in history, and I'm hoping maybe we can repeat it. Yeah, Joel.
I guess I'm so confused by what lesson you're trying to draw from this picture, the realization flow, because even when there's VCS superconductor is much like this in the sense that it looks like a Landau fermi liquid for quite a while, and then it runs off to superconductivity. So in that case, it's a very good situation.
Absolutely. Okay, Joel asked a good question, so then I want to answer it. In the case of BCS, the effects, you're absolutely right. It's one state of matter which we might construe to be a critical point. You know, Fermi C might be a critical point rather than a stable state of matter, becoming unstable to something else. Now, what's different between that and this is the energy scale. You see, suppose it had happened that the fluctuation of the superconductivity cut in at 1 volt. Okay? Well, then you're dead.
So
you would have been dead.
The difference is 160 Kelvin is before you reach that first critical. Where is 160 Kelvin on this curve?
Well, yeah. In other words, unfortunately, let's see. Let's be specific here. So the idea I've got in mind here, to be specific, is you go up here about room temperature, and then you hang there to about 10 times that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the getting up there is fast, but the problem is you don't get away fast. You're going to get stuck there because it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
I'm just curious. Present time, is this quantum critical point that you suspect is there in the phase diagram of Couperet? Is this something that's kind of parasitic?
Parasitic.
Is it obstructing our view of superconductivity?
Okay. Great question. Okay. Zlatko asks, what kind of quantum critical point are we talking about? All right. Now look. The lovely thing about phase transitions is that they're answerable. Okay, I sort of only realized this late in my career, but I've now reformed. it's absolutely true. Michael Fisher was right. Okay, you find a phase, you're done. Okay, you don't argue endlessly about whether this was a plus sign or a minus sign, or whether you divided by pi properly. Okay, it's either there or it's not. Now, thus far, the phases that are potentially present in the cuprates have been covered up. Okay, as of now, we really only know three kinds of order that are potentially present in the problem: mechanical order, which is stripes; superconducting order; and antiferromagnetic order. I personally think that the phase transition responsible for the problem, or the potential problem, is a hidden one. It's a third man. However, this is something that we have to work out experimentally. In other words, what I'm trying to say, it's perfectly possible for a phase transition to be around that is very, very powerful and therefore not parasitic, but at the same time be hard to see because of sensitivity. They're not necessarily connected things. Sorry, yes?
No, there's a fourth type of order, which is there in the quantum Hall effect, topological order, which I think you should mention.
Matthew is right. There could be topological order there, and that's even harder to see. The reason that I am not a big fan of it in this case is because of the power laws. The quantum Hall states are gappy as hell, but this is a stupid discussion. All right, none of us has the ability to predict the phase diagram here. Okay, even though we know the equations. So the name of the game here to do good science is to enumerate the possibilities and describe clean experiments that can distinguish them. This is a very non-trivial activity because most experiments that are easy to do don't. Most experiments are ambiguous. It's very difficult to put your finger on the experiment that will really tell. So if there's topological order, sure. If it's something more traditional that's just difficult to see, that's answerable too. The point is, it doesn't do any good to sit around thinking about it. The trick is to tell our experimentalist friends what they should measure and how you can tell the difference. Steve?
I just wanted to return to Joe's comment.
Yeah.
That, I mean, if we have a fixed point like this that controls the physics over a big scale, then things like estimating TC are not as dismal as you say. That basically TC is determined by the flow away from that fixed point, and we know, I mean, once we understand that fixed point, we know what governs those flows, and
he's right. If you had the full beta function,
I just need it near that unstable fixed point. The TC is determined by how fast you get away.
Yeah.
You're hung up near
Steve,
there for a
Steve,
long time.
Okay, I don't want to take issue with that. You're partially right, okay? If you're nearby in a phase transition in quantum mechanics, and that gives you that modifies the thermodynamics a little bit and enables you to get a grip on maybe what TC is. So the order parameter fluctuation idea is just such an example. Okay, it's more or less a model independent way of estimating TC. Now, this is true, but the difficulty is it's not always true. In other words, it's at least I don't know of any recipe for going from the quantum mechanics to the thermodynamics when you have a transition that's purely quantum. We have some hand-wavy ways of doing it, like when the temperature scale gets to be gaps. Let's say this. You're right in that there's a potential for some predictive power there, but you're not right in that it's not always there. In other words, it's not sufficient. If you know you're scaling over the entire range of energies of interest, that still is not enough information to compute TC. You need more. Shall we break?
I think we're
good. All right.
Thanks for your time.